Welcome to In Context. This is WPKN's live call-in show, broadcast on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. and the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. This is Gus Cantavero, and I'm here with my fellow co-host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Hi, good evening. Ken here. Dave Schwartz isn't able to be with us tonight, so Gus and I will be with you in an extended version of In Context until 11 p.m. when Casey Vaz will take over for us. As you may have known, for those of you who have been listening this afternoon to Bill and Joan, we are in our spring fun drive here at WPKN. Thanks very much for those who have supported us in the drive this week. We don't have anybody here right now to answer your phone, but if you'd like to help us out to continue this great programming, go to WPKN.org, our website, and you can make a secure contribution there. That's WPKN.org, and your support keeps us on the air. Thank you very much. Tonight we're going to do our show in two segments. In the first segment, we're going to discuss the U.S.-NATO military intervention in the Libyan Civil War with a global strategy analyst, Rick Rozoff. And in the second segment of our In Context program, we're going to talk about the controversy over President Obama's birth certificate. And during both segments, we'll be taking your calls, and we'll announce the call-in number in a few minutes. Before we get to the calls, we're going to try to make some sense of this Libyan intervention and with Rick, and we're very fortunate to have him on the phone with us tonight. Rick Rozoff is the founder of the international news list Stop NATO, and his articles can be read at globalresearch.ca and rickrozoff.wordpress.com. Hello, Rick, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, thank you very much for joining us on In Context this evening. Rick, let's get right into it. The U.S. and NATO claim that there's a humanitarian motive for the Libyan intervention. Some critics argue it's simply an oil grab. What's your view, and is there a broader U.S.-NATO strategy involved?
Thanks for having me on. I'm afraid it's another interview and another war. And, I fear it won't be the last of the second, though I would look forward to coming back.
It's been a long time since we've spoken, but yet nothing's changed.
Except we've added one more war to the roster, in addition to the ongoing military occupation of Iraq. And you may have seen last week where the U.S. insists on keeping 15,000 troops there, contrary to the understanding reached with the government. The war in Afghanistan, which will be entering its 11th year on October the 1st with, according to the White House and the Pentagon, at least another 3 years to go beyond that. Longest war in America's history, incidentally, the United States' history. And, another subject people choose not to talk about, what is in essence war in the tribal areas, tribal belt in northwestern Pakistan. So now we have a fourth. We have one in Libya, and there's certainly no assurance we're not going to have another. The title of your program, I think, is more relevant than usual tonight in context. And your question certainly, I think, asked to place the war in Libya, which is known, it's, I believe, 42nd, 43rd day, within context, and, is it a humanitarian intervention? Of course it's not, but, the claim that it is evocative of events of exactly 12 years ago when the United States and NATO went, embarked on its first, on NATO's first war, and the U.S.'s first military action in Europe, excepting, some bombing runs in Bosnia earlier in Yugoslavia. And the same, rationale was employed, or the same pretext was used then. And in many ways, what's going on now is right off the same script. And, is it a war for oil? In part, I would suspect. Libya does have the largest proven oil reserves in Africa. And currently, although, Canada, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela are the largest exporters of oil to the United States, Angola and Nigeria come fifth and sixth, not necessarily in that order. So Africa increasingly is becoming a source of hydrocarbons for the United States. It's also, vitally important for Europe. If the ongoing U.S.-led efforts to exclude Russia, as both a natural gas and an oil exporter to Europe go ahead, then, substitute will have to be found elsewhere, and Libya seems to be a good place for it. But I think there are a number of other factors that you hinted at that are worth developing. When the war began on March 19th, with an estimated 110 to 112 Tomahawk cruise missiles fired into Libya on the first day from U.S. and British warships and submarines in the Mediterranean. For the, you know, from the 19th of March to the end of that month, the war was being waged under the auspices of U.S. Africa Command. It's, you know, first war for the U.S.'s newest regional overseas military command. And on March 31st was transferred to NATO. Nothing much but a change of name from Operation Odyssey Dawn to Operation Unified Provider perhaps has been affected. But, you know, in the interim, what we've seen is over 4,000 air missions flown by NATO. That's just since March 31st, culminating last night, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, in reports that the youngest son of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was killed with three of his children. And by accounts, you know, perhaps dozens of people killed, including friends and neighbors. The talk show circuit this morning with the likes of John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who were, you know, kind of shadow defense ministers anymore, or defense secretaries, you know, where McCain's comment that if Gaddafi himself had been killed, that would be fine and such like. You know, a week ago, Lindsey Graham on American television, on Easter Sunday, moreover, you know, talked about cutting off the head of the snake. I mean, these are incitements to killing not only Gaddafi, but family members and other government
officials. Let me cut you off there, because, and don't lose your place, because I want to go back to it, but in the U.S., wait, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't the U.S. have a policy against assassinations?
Well, that's very interesting. I'm glad you asked that. You know, the chief legal advisor of the U.S. State Department is a person named Harold Koh, K-O-H. And, you know, he rendered a decision, if you will, a couple of years ago that the, you know, ongoing CIA-directed drone missile attacks in Pakistan, which have killed, you know, over 2,000 people.
Yeah.
By the estimate of one NGO in Pakistan recently, last year alone, 975 Pakistani civilians were killed in these drone attacks with Hellfire missiles.
Yeah, they just launch missiles at weddings just because there's one guest there who they think is a worthy target.
Right, or, you know, as is somewhat customary in the region, if somebody fires a, you know, a gun into the air at a wedding or something, that's, that's interpreted as a hostile action in the, you know, the entire community.
It must be terrorism, right?
You're right, right. But, you know, Harold Koh determined that what the United States is doing with Predator drones, which are now, of course, being used in Libya, the order there by the White House last week, were not targeted assassinations. They were targeted killings.
Nice. Come on.
That's a precious distinction, yeah. How do we get to this point? You know, you get from Washington and Jefferson avoiding entangling alliances and a really disdain for these foreign adventures down to assassinating people anywhere in the world.
Yeah, Washington said don't get entangled in treaties. You know, don't even have treaties, let alone, you know, assassinating foreign leaders without having a jury or a trial of any type.
You mentioned AFRICOM earlier. Most Americans have probably never even heard of AFRICOM. What is AFRICOM?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. U.S. Africa Command is one of six regional, for the most part, overseas U.S. military commands. The U.S. is alone in the world, of course, in dividing the entire globe up into military commands, as it is into naval commands. There are six of those also. And what U.S. Africa Command, it achieved what in you know, Pentagon lingo is called full operational capability on October 1st, 2008. It had partial you know, operational capability for a year earlier. It was nurtured by U.S. European Command. You know, in many ways still overlaps. U.S. Marine Corps Africa, for example, U.S. Naval Forces Africa, Europe, you know, are a joint enterprise. And the chief commander of U.S. European Command, EUCOM, currently is an admiral, first time, James Stavridis, who simultaneously is NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe. Isn't that a nice name? Doesn't it sound reminiscent of the Roman Empire or something? AFRICOM was nurtured by NATO as much as it was by EUCOM at the time, and you know, has been looking for a mission, and it's found one, which is war in North Africa. It's also been involved. It has a full-time military presence in the North East African Horn of Africa nation, Djibouti, where there are an estimated 2,500 U.S. troops that have been there. Actually, a deal was struck before 9/11 for U.S. troops to be stationed in the strategic horn of Africa and Djibouti, before the claim of global war and terror could be.
And this is the Gulf, really, to control the Gulf of Aden, right?
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's one of the key sea routes and choke points in the world.
And that's why Yemen is important, too, right?
There you go, exactly. It's immediately across the Gulf of Aden. So, you know, Africa was given its, baptism by fire, its inauguration, with so-called Operation Odyssey Dawn, as we were talking about on March 19th. And, by the way, they were running the operation from the flagship of the U.S. 6th Fleet, which is assigned to the Mediterranean Sea, USS Mount Whitney. So everyone got into the deal. U.S. European Command, the U.S. 6th Fleet, Africa Command, and, of course, you know, since March 31st, this has been run by NATO. In a real sense, this is the first major war, even though the U.S. Remains involved, of course, and as we talked about a moment ago, has now supplied two Predator drones. This is the first time a full-fledged war has been run openly under NATO auspices.
It seems like the whole theme of the last several years has been to transform a World War II defensive alliance into give it a new mission, create an offensive alliance out of it in order to fulfill hegemony over the world.
No, you're absolutely correct about that. You know, NATO held its summit, which have now become annual events, incidentally. NATO summits in the not-too-distant past were held every other year. They're now held annually. And last year's in November 20th and 21st, was held in Lisbon, Portugal, at which point, for the first time in a decade, NATO introduced a new strategic concept, as they call it. And the leaders of NATO and now up to 28 members from 16 members slightly over 12 years ago, openly talked about its global mission, international security provider, that sort of thing. So it's been refashioned, as you allude to, from a titular regional defense bloc. I mean, hence its name, right? I mean, or North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has now waged wars in three continents, has 140 of the 152,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan assigned to its international security assistance force. Is waging what apparently is a permanent naval operation in the area we were talking about earlier, the Horn of Africa in the Gulf of Aden, something called Operation Ocean Shield. Incidentally, there's a report a few days ago that a warship designed to NATO with Operation Ocean Shield had fired on fishing vessels in the area, wounded several Iranians, and killed, three or four Somalis. So it would have been
the purpose of what?
Fighting machine.
For the purpose of what? Why did they fire on a fishing vessel?
I suspected them of being pirates. they had to use up their ammunition. I mean, I have no idea.
Practice?
Yeah, practice. There you go. Target practice.
Oh, my God.
One of the aspects of NATO that you document so well is these ever-expanding alliances. In addition to the full membership in NATO, they have all these junior memberships, whether they call them partnerships for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the network is ever-extending. And one of the aspects of the Libyan invasion that you emphasize is that Libya was one of only five African nations who refused to enter a military partnership with NATO and the U.S.
Yeah, I found that interesting.
Yeah, and I first mentioned that I think these interviews like the current one are very useful for me because in the course of discussions of the sort we're having, ideas crystallize in one's mind. And I was doing an interview earlier this year with a Canadian radio station, just on the spot in the course of our discussion, I happened to kind of tick off in my own mind. How many African countries have not been involved with Africa military exercises? By the way, there are 11 this year. And some of them are multinational exercises that include 30 or 35 African countries at one time. And, of course, NATO has a partnership that goes back to the 90s called Mediterranean Dialogue, which includes two of the countries actually don't border the Mediterranean, Mauritania and Jordan. But they include, Israel, Tunisia, Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, and of course Tunisia and Egypt border, and Algeria border Libya. And Libya was the only North African country not to be part of that, NATO program. As it is, one of the few countries in Africa, probably five, now you can count on four with the overthrow of the government in Ivory Coast last month, You know, and it begs the question, and the remaining three, which at least in my book are what's left of Sudan, Eritrea and Zimbabwe, when their day is coming.
Let me just announce the call-in number for our listeners who'd like to join our conversation. It's 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to join our In Context conversation with Rick Rozef about the Libyan intervention and the broader NATO policy around the world.
Yeah, I have a few questions. I'm sure we could take a lot more than a half hour to cover all this. I've got at least six or seven of them here, and each one of them are 15 minutes. But do you see any connection between, especially since you just named a few countries who don't participate in things, did you see any connection between the Egyptian spontaneous revolution and its overthrow of Mubarak and the fact that Mubarak reportedly did not want to take place in a Libyan intervention in the upcoming months, and so he was seen as someone who had to be removed as a roadblock? Do you see anything there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating question, and I wish I could answer it more thoroughly. You know, I just saw, by the way, an article that the British Foreign Secretary is heading to Egypt, where he's going to meet with, you know, the Field Marshal, who's now head of state in the country.
Mm-hmm.
What's the actual title?
In Egypt?
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, at the bottom of what is basically nothing more than a press release, it mentions, you know, they're going to discuss Libya and Syria, as
mm-hmm.
I'm sure they are.
What has to make the United States nervous about the front on to the east of Libya when the new Egyptian government has allowed the opening of the Gaza Strip to, you know, to so that mm-hmm. supplies and whatnot can go through, which had been closed by Mubarak in cooperation with Israel's demands. So I think there's got to be a lot of concern that Egypt is no longer under our thumb, and if Egypt gets out of control, then...
Or they're at least using the leverage that they have to get something that they want in exchange for something else.
Egypt appears to have, as I understand it, brokered the settlement between Hamas and Fatah, which of course is also upsetting to the U.S. and Israel. So there may be a significant change in Egyptian policy coming out of this.
You know, one should hope so, because what's been...
We actually have a phone call, if you'd like to take a break here.
Sure.
Hold on a second.
Hello,
Carl, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
You're on the air. Can you tell us where you're calling from, listener?
I'm calling from Toledo, Ohio.
Oh, you're
signal reaches that far?
An internet listener. That's great. Thank you. Please go ahead with your call for Rick Rozef.
Yeah, no, I actually, it was a comment. I've been following the Libyan story very closely, and one thing that the major media seems to be ignoring is the China connection.
Okay.
I saw there's a great article on Al Jazeera English, and unfortunately, I was unable to bring it up. My computer's on the fritz.
Isn't that a terrorist network? I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Al Jazeera.
But the article talked about China's interest in Libya, and particularly North Africa. It seems that China is right now playing a chess game with the United States, with AFRICOM specifically, for control of the region. I mean, China has had very strong investment in Gaddafi himself and has strongly condemned the NATO intervention. So it seems to appear to me, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, Mr. Rozef, on the Chinese involvement. Are the Chinese seeking to eclipse us in Africa as the future players?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Go ahead, Rick.
First of all, I lived in Toledo for 2 years in my early teens, and they were the formative years. So you could either credit or blame Toledo for what I'm doing tonight, but I still think of it very fondly. I'm a native Buckeye also. You know, you've heard reports, as I have, that when the unrest in Libya began in March, that the figure I'm familiar with is that 30,000 Chinese workers were evacuated from the country. You know, unfortunately, the Chinese government has not said a blessed thing about the war to speak of. There's a little more grumbling from Russia. You know, China's general policy is to sit back and allow things to happen. You're talking about not too many months ago, has officially become the world's second largest economy, China having surpassed Japan in that category, and one that has nothing like what it needs in terms of oil and natural gas reserves, which, you know, almost nothing, in fact, and needs to obtain those elsewhere. I mean, you can do that by fair means or foul, and I would say the record with China is they've done it by fair means.
Yeah, they seem to be, from what I understand, investing heavily in Africa, repaving roads, building railroads, dams, opening hospitals, so that they seem to be creating a lot of goodwill in Africa.
Yeah. Well, the Chinese strategy seems to be more of a Go approach, if you will. A popular board game in China is Go, which is the objective of the game as opposed to chess, where you wear down your enemy by attrition. The idea is to claim as much territory as possible using as few pieces as possible. And so as opposed to building 300 military bases around the world, they tell the government in Khartoum, hey, you know, listen, we'll give you all of these relatively modern, in most cases antiquated arms for free, as long as you give us rights to your oil, that sort of thing.
What a steal.
I mean, that's a keen observation, and it suggests, you know, that Russia also has major oil, natural gas interests on the continent, including in Ivory Coast, which I presume they no longer have, and Libya. I mean, traditionally, going back to the Soviet period, there were close state-to-state relations between, Soviet Russia and Libya. I'm going to have to assume that, you know, both China and Russia have been knocked out of the running in both respects. In the case of Ivory Coast, we're talking about the Gulf of Guinea, you know, which is one of the most oil-rich and underexploited, oil-rich areas in the world right now. And one of the arguments for the creation of AFRICOM, and this was documented years in advance of its inauguration, was that the U.S.'s major concern was precisely that area of West Africa, you know, the Atlantic coast of West Africa, the Gulf of Guinea. And that, many of the, a lion's share of the military exercises and visits and so forth by what's called the Africa Partnership Station, which is a subject of another discussion sometime, U.S. naval visits to almost every coastal country in Africa and the island nations. Is China being knocked out of, acquiring natural gas and particularly oil rights in Africa? I have to assume it is.
Well, they're in the Sudan heavily, right? It was not a big part of the reason why we wanted to partition the south of Sudan, Chinese ambitions.
Which has been achieved. And as a matter of fact, South Sudan, which I think is the title of the nation, we'll assume it was Southern Sudan before then, is already participated even before the independence referendum in U.S. military exercises. U.S.-led military exercises. So, I mean, that's another acquisition, as is now Ivory Coast, and intended, I'm sure, Libya. Is there a new scramble for Africa with China on one side and the U.S. and the European Union on the other? Yes, I'm sure there is. But as the caller mentioned, and this does not have to be resolved by military means.
Yeah, caller, did you have a follow-up question, or...?
Well, what I wonder is, I mean, could this eventually lead to particularly the United States and China locking horns more so over the issue? I mean, I personally highly doubt them militarily intervening, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least if they decided to supply arms to Gaddafi's troops. I mean, they may obey be doing that now. I mean, the way they've been really hammering the rebels, it does pose the question if we're going to start...
And may the Chinese start to develop their military.
We thank you very much for the call.
Thanks very much, caller.
It was my pleasure.
Libya is already pretty well funded and established as it is. Would they even need any outside assistance other than having a joint effort to flank on the other side?
Well, that brings us to the Libyans' money.
I have a couple of points.
The sovereign wealth fund and all the huge, $150 billion I've heard in the Libyan sovereign wealth fund.
In addition to many, many tons of gold.
Of gold, and which they've been using to invest in largely in sub-Saharan Africa, which would wean the sub-Saharan African nations away from the dependence on Western bankers.
I just want to ask Rick specifically on this issue. We know that Libya had a state-run oil company and a state bank, so it would take the profits from their investments, put it right back into infrastructure for the people. It's very popular among the citizens there, and that explains why he's so popular amongst a large group of the citizenry of Libya. But the first thing that the revolutionaries did was to establish a private central bank, which is not something that revolutionaries tend to do as a first order of business. What are your thoughts?
I mean, that's also a keen point. There was a statement about 2 days ago by a Russian analyst, you know, think tank analyst, who mentioned that, you know, and we have to, when we're talking about Libya, let's think a step ahead for about Syria, because, you know, all indications are the model could be played out there, too, at any time. But this the Russian analyst in question, you know, mentioned that in the entire Arab world right now, Libya and Syria are the only two countries that still have anything like or have had, you know, a socialist orientation. This doesn't mean socialism, and, you know, maybe in the sense that most of us would understand, it does mean a strong state sector, which is, I think, more what you're talking about. And that if you, you know, look at the other 22 or 23 members of the Arab League, there are no other countries that match that description.
Mm-hmm.
So are we dealing with the only two truly non-aligned countries in the Arab world right now, and the only two with a strong state sector that places national interest above subordination of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and so forth?
Right.
I think we are.
Mm-hmm. One of the institutions that should be important in Africa is the African Union. What's the role that it's playing in these interventions?
Unfortunately, it's comparable to that of the United Nations or the Arab League. You know, when you're I'm quoting President Barack Obama from his Nobel Prize, you know, peace acceptance speech.
I have that speech framed in my office.
Pardon me?
I said I have that speech framed in my office.
Oh, dear God Almighty, where, you know, he openly boasts, and I'm using his exact words, that the United States is the world's sole military superpower.
Uh-huh.
And then complains that other countries are resentful of that, as I recall.
How dare they?
But when you reach that sort of status, you don't you don't brook any opposition. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a very compliant Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, who is every bit as subservient to the United States as was his predecessor, Kofi Annan. We have an Arab League that is coached to ask for military intervention in an Arab country, which then Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton cite as the reason why they went to war against you know, Libya. And then we have an African Union which whose leadership seems to be playing along with that. I wrote an article a couple months ago about a leading report I can't verify, but it seemed, you know, to ring true, where a leading African Union official was talking about signing a compact or a deal with NATO collectively, you know, to enter into a partnership with the 53, soon to be 54 member states of the African Union. So if we seriously analyze the post-Cold War period right now, we have to say that the United States has been able to dominate the United Nations and now seems to, you know, pretty much have the Arab League and even the African Union on board with them.
Yeah, our time is running out with you, Rick. I just wanted to ask one more question. One of the important things that Obama said when going into this intervention, whatever you want to call it, war, military action, intervention, etc., the names just keep going. But one of the things that Obama promised was that we were not going to have a ground invasion, that there wouldn't be any ground troops going in. Now, when it started, he just, you know, heard the UN say we wanted to go in, and he jumped without consulting Congress or anything like that, and that really irked me. But now that it's been transferred from the UN to NATO, and NATO really and the United States really controls NATO, is NATO going to send in U.S. ground troops to invade as a cover of semantics without making Obama look like a liar, because U.S. troops will still go in there, but they'll be under NATO command, which is really United States command, but technically it won't be an American invasion?
I mean, that's exactly what's happening in Afghanistan. We have 100,000 U.S. troops, probably 90,000 of which are under NATO command. Though we have the, you know, U.S. General Petraeus, who's going to be our new CIA director.
Yeah, that's exciting.
You know, in charge of, again, the militarization of intelligence and vice versa.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, again, if we look at the parallel, if we look at the template that was the 78-day bombing campaign against Yugoslavia 12 years ago, you know, within 3 days, in altogether, you know, 1,000 warplanes on 38,000 combat missions, you know, in 3 days claimed they had destroyed every military target at least accessible to them, but continued bombing for another 75 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the more frustrated, at that time President Clinton and other NATO leaders became with the lack of progress on that front, the more you heard talk from the likes of General Wesley Clark and Tony Blair in Britain and so forth about a ground operation. So I would have to say, you know, if, according to Messier, McCain and Graham and so forth today, they don't succeed in landing a lucky missile that wipes out what's left of the Gaddafi family, and because the government is not going to capitulate, the Libyan government is not going to capitulate, then, yeah, we may be looking at the possibility. There's already talk of a European Union troop deployment, you know, a humanitarian corridor. That's precisely the term and the concept that was used in Yugoslavia after, over 2 months of bombing, failed to achieve its objective and so forth. So, I don't know. I mean, these are all possibilities. But I think what they're looking at is probably at this point, wiping out the political leadership of Libya and then having, capitulation. Barring that, the prospect of a ground operation is not to be ruled out.
And by the way, isn't shooting missiles into a house where little kids are living, isn't that a war crime?
In the mind of any sensible, decent human being, of course it is. The way that it's being portrayed by NATO and U.S. officials is anything that is deemed to be a command and control center is fair game. And, there have been repeated, oh, by the way, this is very interesting, the NATO website, you can just type in NATO in any search engine, since they took control of the naval blockade and the bombing operations on March 31st, have published daily reports. And for some reason today, May the 1st, they did not. The first day they missed, within hours of bombing the compound, killing Gaddafi family members. Apparently that was too obvious, so they took a day off.
Well, I'm afraid Rick, we're going to have to leave it there, but could you give us the websites where your articles, your excellent articles on NATO and these and the wars can be seen?
Yeah, thanks for those generous characterization. The best thing is it's called Stop NATO. I think if you type in those two words, the first two entries ought to be both the email list, which I encourage people to join. There's a daily digest with one email a day, and also the blog website, which is also called Stop NATO. Or you can just type in Rozoff, R-O-Z-O-F-F,
and people can subscribe and get your articles that way.
Yeah, please do. That's where I get my information.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being with us, Rick.
No, thank you both. It's been very very helpful for me.
Good night now.
Thanks, Rick.
Bye.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming at WPKN.org. The name of the show is In Context, WPKN's live call-in show. We're going to take a break before our next second segment, which will be on President Obama's birth certificate. And we'd like your input, too. Gus and I are going to discuss that, and we'll announce the phone call after the break.
And if you haven't seen it yet, we have a detailed analysis on the blog at incontextreport.com. So if you want to call in and have questions about that, go ahead and check it out at the website.
So there you have a copy of the birth certificate on that.
Yep, and there's blow-ups and real close details.
Gus may talk about his detailed analysis of the birth certificate. So if you take a look at it while we're playing the music break, then you'll maybe have it, if you have an opportunity to have it in front of you, when we're talking about it, that would be good.
Be right back.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. down, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
And we are back. So
you're listening to In Context, WPKN's live call-in show on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. And this is our spring fund drive. There's nobody right now at the station at this hour to answer the phone calls for your pledge, but we'd encourage you to go to WPKN.org, where you can make a secure pledge online to support the station. And we really appreciate your listener support. It's what allows us to stay on the air, bringing in the kind of guests that we have on In Context. So thanks very much for your support. In the second segment, we're going to look at President Obama's birth certificate, and my fellow host Gus Canavero is a graphic designer, and he has some expertise in analyzing photographs, images, online digital images, mm-hmm. and he took a very careful look at the birth certificate, and his report on it, his analysis and copies of the birth certificate are online on our website, incontextreport.com. So, Gus, maybe you could summarize what your analysis
showed. Yeah, and you know, I don't like to mention what I do for a living, because it's, the show isn't about me. It's about the information, and you know, I never want to mention that sort of stuff. But here, it's relevant, and you know, I am a photographer and a graphic designer. I was a graphic designer. It's what I went to school for originally, and I spend an inordinate amount of time looking at images and analyzing images and retouching images and getting in really close. So if there's anything that I feel that I'm qualified to speak about, it would be that. and so if we just go through the timeline, back in 2008, there were questions during the campaign, and Hillary Clinton originally raised the question about the birth certificate and wanted to know what the deal was there. And what was released back then was called the Certificate of Live Birth. And that's the short form birth certificate, which is essentially just a receipt for the birth certificate. It's something that you can get from the hospital by sending in a request to get it. You know, they can't send you the original, but they will give you the certificate of live birth. And you can get a certificate of live birth in any number of situations. You don't have to be born here to have one. You could be born someplace else, come to this country, and then get a certificate of live birth by showing proof of birth. And that will serve as your birth certificate while here in the United States. So there's a lot of ways that you can get it. If you adopt a child, you know, they may not have a birth certificate, but you need something to show where they're from and all that sort of stuff, so you can get one of those things. There's been a lot of questions about the reports that were in the newspapers, the announcements, the birth announcements. And they said that they were not filed by the grandparents, because originally the argument was, oh no, well, the birthers were saying, well, the grandparents called and made the birth announcement, you know, because they were happy that their grandchild was born, even though it was in Kenya or whatever. But by filing for that certificate of live birth, I believe that can trigger a birth announcement from the hospital. So whether the child was actually born in the hospital or not, by filing that paperwork, it triggers that announcement. But that's actually not what we're not even here to talk about. I'm just giving the timeline. And then on Thursday morning, he gets on television, cuts into all the live programming, and says, here's my birth certificate, here's the real deal. I don't have time to answer these questions. I'm too busy for this kind of stuff. This is ridiculous. It's a big waste of my time. It's a distraction from all the real issues.
But he had stoutly resisted for a long time.
He had spent many millions of dollars fighting the lawsuits of attorney Phil Berg, who is a Democrat himself and has chaired a number of Democratic organizations, and was actually a supporter of Hillary Clinton during the campaign, but has since then seen that the Democrat Party is also a party of war, just like the Republican Party, and is now fighting staunchly against this war machine, and is spending most of his time in the courts filing Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get information on Obama to show that it's just one fraud after another. And so millions of dollars have been spent fighting this lawsuit, and then he just gets on TV and says, here it is. Well, Phil Berg wants to know, why were you spending millions of dollars fighting my lawsuit when you're just going to come out here and give it away?
So now, you, when you looked at it, it purports to be an exact copy of the original birth certificate. It's not something that's produced as a transcript of a certificate. It mm-hmm. supposedly has the original signature of Obama's mother on it, right? So this
yes.
is supposed to be the original deal, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the real deal. It has everything on it that it should have. Some states have the footprints and the birth weight and length and all that sort of stuff. This one, it appears, does not. There's no box for that stuff. So some people want to know where's that sort of stuff. Well, you know, I looked at my wife's birth certificate. I looked at my son's birth certificate. They don't have a footprint on theirs either. And I know that my son was born in America.
Well, what were the shortcomings in it? You found some.
All right, yeah. Well, the shortcomings... The problems, there are a lot of, I think, misinformation out there about what the problems are with the birth certificate and what's true and what isn't. All right, I can tell you what I can prove right here by looking at the birth certificate is that there are multiple very serious problems with the digital file that they put online. What they put online is called a PDF format document. And it's a format that's created by Adobe Corporation about back in the early 90s as a quick way to transfer text documents that also have images in them. So you can quickly compile them into a small file size to make it very easily transferable through email, things like that. So you have a lot of controls for compression of text and images. And what's special about it is that it keeps the text live. Now, what I mean by live is that, like, if you are in Microsoft Word or something, as most people are familiar with, or in their email or something like that, you can take your cursor and you can highlight the text and you can copy and paste it and edit it and so forth. Now, when you scan a document in, an image, that text is no longer live. It becomes what's called rasterized. Now, the difference between a raster graphic and a vector graphic is that a raster graphic uses pixels, where each pixel has its own color assigned to it. It'll calculate so many pixels in from the left, those are black, and then so many up from top to bottom, those are also black, and the black ends down here. And depending on the resolution of the file, the sharper those lines will be. And if it's a low resolution, those lines will begin to fade out and blur. So when you zoom in very tightly, it'll go from a stark deep black to a slightly less gray, slightly less gray, slightly less gray, and then eventually off to another color, or white, or whatever it is. Now, with a vector graphic, it uses vectors, which are radiuses or barriers or boundaries, probably the best word to use. So it'll calculate the X and Y coordinates of all of the outlines and then fill in those vectors. All right? Now, a vector is infinitely scalable. You can scale it infinitely small and infinitely large because it uses borders and boundaries, and those boundaries can be moved in and out, and it'll maintain the fundamentals of the shape, whereas when you blow up a raster graphic, which uses pixels, those pixels will start to break apart and become really pixelated at larger sizes, which is why when sometimes online, if you go into Google search for images, for like a kid's report, and they always pick out an image out of Google Images, they'll pick out something that's really low resolution, you go to print it out, and when you print it out, it looks all pixelated and broken apart. You see all the pixels. That's because it's a low resolution image. And it doesn't have the strength, the resolution to hold up when you blow it up. All right, now that's the biggest fundamental part you need to understand about the technical aspect of this. Now, when you look at this document and you zoom in on it, you can see 99% of the text in this document is a vector graphic. All right, now to have a vector graphic, you have to have type, live type that you've typed in, or you've converted from another format or something like that. When you take a document, you put it on your scanner, or you take a digital photograph of it, and you bring it into the computer, it is entirely rasterized. The computer doesn't know what text is unless you've told it so.
So if it's an old document that had been typed 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that it would not have this property.
It would only be rasterized because you would take that piece of paper, which was typed, hand-typed,
right,
lay it on your flatbed scanner, scan it and bring it into whatever image processing program, and then you would save it as a JPEG or whatever image format.
The fact that it's vectorized indicates it's not an old document.
Exactly. Now, what you can do with Adobe Illustrator, which is the document, which is the program I use to bring this PDF into, I opened it up in Adobe Illustrator, and it immediately broke out into layers, meaning that when I moved my cursor around, it started drawing selection boxes around all the independent elements.
Now, this couldn't happen if it were really an old document.
It couldn't, no, because it would be a flat image file that I could not manipulate in any way. If I clicked and dragged, it would drag the entire thing as an image.
Yes.
Whereas what we have here is when you look at, say, the dates and most of the information about the locations, the names, pretty much all the specifics on there, all of those, when you zoom in really close, they maintain their sharpness. Whereas the background breaks apart and becomes pixelated. So I know by looking at it that the background is a rasterized image, whereas the text is vector.
So you take an old form and then you assemble new information upon it?
Basically what they did was they took the watermark, which is the green cross-hatching background, which as far as I can ascertain did not come into use until at least the mid-80s. And this is a birth certificate from 1961, so I don't believe that it's even possible that this green watermark could have been used as a background.
So even the paper was old, but it wasn't that old, perhaps.
Yeah, no, they took paper, they loaded that into an image manipulation program, then they got scans of the samples of the signatures and of typewriter type of all of the names, and basically all you have to do is just get a couple samples of an A, a couple samples of a B, a couple samples of a C. You can start to rearrange those to spell out words. A trained eye, when you look at those, you'll know, oh, this is the same letter A repeating. And now they have a couple in there that do repeat, but not a lot. So basically what they did was they had more than one sample.
But again, this wouldn't be characteristic of an old document that had been...
Well, no, I mean, either way... the fact that these elements are separate from the background,
yes,
that is a dead giveaway that this document is manufactured.
That is manufactured. If you'd like to join this conversation, we're talking about President Obama's birth certificate, which is recently posted on the Internet. You can call us at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. I'm Ken McDermott. I'm here with Gus Candavero, and the name of our program is In Context, and we are on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming on WPKN.org.
Now, one of the things that's significant as well is that there's white ghosting around all of the text and signatures that you can see in there. So there's black lines for all the signatures and text and outlines and everything. And then there's there's white ghosting that is called fringing. So there's white fringing around all the elements. And why that's important is because when you're transferring an element from one document to another, you have to get in there really close and select it and remove the background. Otherwise, when you just drag and drop it, you'll have a white box.
Right.
So if you want to take a signature, and I demonstrate how easy this is on the website, I take the signature of a name, of a woman's name, Julia, and I took it off of a pink sticky paper, a post-it note, and then I used elements of tools in Photoshop to be able to remove that color, the paper, from around it so that the only thing that remains is the name Julia. And then I take it and I transfer it onto that green watermark background that the birth certificate is on, and it looks just as good, if not better, than what the other person did. And I used an incorrect method to do this, quick and dirty, basically, just to do it fast and show how it can be done. I would do it better than that if I was going to do it, though. I wouldn't do it that way. There's better ways to do it. So they chose a very rudimentary method to transfer these signatures from one paper to another, to reassemble them into one document.
It sounds like, from your analysis, that this wasn't the most expert job ever done, and yet the main media, the mainstream media, the New York Times front page article and networks, they accepted this without question,
right,
and they denigrated anybody who would have questioned the authenticity of the document.
Right. That's what's most frustrating to me, because I'm looking at it and I know that it's full of these dead giveaways, that there are major problems with it that I could tell immediately the second I looked at it, and I feel kind of crazy because it's almost like, I mean...
Well, it reminds me of other stories we've covered, that the media never examines the critics or the criticisms. They just denigrate the critics and ignore any objections, however meritorious they might be.
Yeah, I mean, this thing is just rife with errors. There's if you look on the left side of where all the text area is, there's a strange curvature of the document that just sort of disappears, and it's clearly taken from a bound volume. Like if you take a book with a binding and you just lay it on a scanner and you scan that in, or a Xerox copy of it, you'll have a fade off into the spine. And so there's clearly something there, and then it just disappears. And if you zoom into where that area is happening, you can see that the compression of the that part where it's fading into the bound volume, and anyone who's seen the document should know what I'm talking about, where it just stops and then it picks up into the fresh part of the template of the outside of the document. The outside has very sharp lines in the cross-hatching of the watermark, but the inside has a very blocky, pixelated, compressed background of the watermark. So it shows that those were two different documents, that they were just inserted together, like they cut out a window and then just placed it inside. And then, you know, in addition to that, I never really follow the comment sections on YouTube or, you know, on articles on websites, because they're just a total waste of time. Most people just are, you know, sniping at each other with sarcastic comments. But I did see that a few people were, you know, making up stories saying, oh, no, this is the reason why the text is breaking out into layers is because it's using OCR, which is optical character recognition. And that's a program you can run a text document that you've scanned. So it's a completely raster image. There's no live text on there, and you can run an OCR program on there, and it will say, oh, this clearly says, you know, this word here and there, this is a poem, you know, and so it'll start to pick out the words and letters, and it'll convert those visual raster images into live text and words, so that you can convert a scan of a book into a Word document.
But that's not what was done here.
But that's not what's done here, for two reasons. One, they would have had to actually run that application on it for that to happen. It doesn't automatically happen by me opening the document.
Right.
This doesn't do that. Why would it perform a function that I don't need without me asking for it to do that?
Yes.
And second, for an image specialist to run OCR on this document when they scanned it in would really leave them open for criticism, because it would mean that they intended to do fraud.
Right. Why would they make it manipulable?
Exactly.
If you'd like to join our conversation about President Obama's birth certificate, the number is 203-336-9756. We only have a few minutes left in this segment, I believe.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left.
And so if you'd like to join the conversation, I think we should talk about, why is this important?
Yeah.
You know, again, we, and listeners, this is not a partisan attack on the part of Gus and myself. We have given the Bushes, senior and junior, a lot of heat on our program. We're not coming at this from a partisan point of view, but there's something very fishy here.
No, we just want justice. You know, we're just tired of being lied to, and Obama came in as a candidate of change and peace, and as we just talked to Rick about all the wars going on, clearly, you know, we have not elected a candidate of peace. And now also I see we haven't elected a candidate of change, because we have just fraud after fraud thrown in our faces. You know, things like the health care bill, you know, everyone has to buy health care unless you're a friend of the campaign, and then you get waivers like McDonald's. But, you know, why did he spend millions of dollars fighting the lawsuits of Bill Berg?
It seems to be, and there's a lot of work been done. A lot of work has been done on this by Wayne Mattson, who's a very important independent investigative journalist. he's looked at the Obama background, and he's found a lot of CIA connections, right? Going back to his maternal grandfather, Stanley Armour Dunham, his wife, Madeleine Dunham, and their daughter, Anne, who was Obama's mother. The grandparents, it seems, were in the OSS during World War II, stationed in Beirut, and it's not clear exactly what was going on in the 40s and 50s, but it seems like at least the father was still in Beirut as then a CIA operative, and that the mother ends up in Hawaii around 1960 working for the Bank of Hawaii, where, according to Mattson, she becomes the paymaster, the CIA paymaster, for Asian politicians who are basically on the CIA payroll.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a pretty important functionary. He, meanwhile, is supposed to be traveling all over the country, he being Stanley Dunham, working as a furniture store salesman. It's very bizarre. He's working for all these furniture store companies. But Mattson said it's really just a CIA cover for his government operations. And when you dig into it, you find out that his military records are unavailable. He has an FBI file that's unavailable. It's classified or destroyed. And then you dig further. Where does Obama come from? And you look at his school records for Occidental and from Columbia College. And we can't look at them. They're all secret.
Well,
so what's going on?
That's
here?
Exactly what Phil Berg is insinuating, that the reason why he spends so much money trying to fight the Freedom of Information Act request to get the birth certificate and because his school records and everything else would come out as well, and there's probably something that he's hiding in there.
It certainly looks, if Madison's reporting is accurate, that CIA, that the Obama was CIA from the word go. And I think that is very important, because we know that from the work of, say, Kevin Phillips, that the Bush family was CIA, has been CIA since before there was a CIA. Now, if it turns out Obama was CIA from the time, from his grandparents' time and as a very young man, then we know that, once again, it's a Tweedledum, Tweedledee situation.
Mm-hmm.
Or as the Simpson fans would say, Kang and Kodos, you get the same people in charge, regardless of who you vote for.
Yeah. Now, there are a lot of really important aspects of the paperwork and the laws that are implicated here, because there's a lot of rumors out there on the internet, and it's just a great way for someone to just say something and then no one fact checks it, they just repeat it. So there are a lot of rumors. I think a couple things I looked into I'd like to clarify. Phil Berg, again, is an attorney, so he's a good source to go to for some clarification on these things. And the reason why the birth certificate is important, for many reasons, actually, but, because a lot of people say, well, does it matter his mother was an American citizen, so what should it matter where he was born? It really shouldn't. But the fact that his mother's age when she had him is important, and it's kind of nitpicky, but at the time, in 1961, the law stated that you had to be an American citizen for at least 5 years, and then after the age of 14, so that means 19 years old, in order to have a natural-born citizen child.
Right.
And natural-born means a child who is a citizen without any necessary paperwork. So in other words, naturalized means you have to have paperwork to become naturalized.
Right.
Natural-born means you're born without any effort to become a citizen. So Stanley Ann Dunham was only 18 years old when she had him. So if she indeed was abroad when she had him, and especially the fact that the father was a Kenyan citizen, it's important.
Question
it's very important.
On his citizenship. And, of course, how did she happen to get acquainted with Barack Sr.? He was attending a CIA-sponsored school,
mm-hmm.
Called the East-West Institute at Hawaii University. And he was brought over because he was a protege of a CIA-backed Kenyan leader.
Mm-hmm.
So they have this, CIA connection with husband number one, and then of course she marries Sotero as husband number two,
yep.
Who is an Indonesian officer who in 65 goes back to Indonesia to take part in a CIA-sponsored coup that removes Sukarno.
Right.
And then of course Ann Dunham, this is again Obama's mother, ends up working for the CIA front organization, the Aid for International Development, and other organizations which she probably had CIA connections.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing this whole pattern. This guy Obama did not come out of nowhere. So the fact that he gives us more war than just as much war as the Bush family gives, that he's totally online with the suppression of our civil rights and with secrecy, with the torture and the secret prisons, we can't be that surprised.
And then just to add another layer to that law that I just cited is that later on, I think it was in 1987. I think that law was reduced 1 year, so it was 14 plus 3. So I think it made 17 instead, or whatever it was. I think it was lowered to the age of 17 instead of 19. So later on, you know, that's why I think it's kind of nitpicky to follow on that. But
yeah,
the law is the law.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it. My personal thought is that this suggests a whole milieu that he came out of a CIA handpicked tradition, and we have been totally deceived into thinking he's some kind of grassroots phenomena, and we should not be misled about this, and that's no surprise.
Yeah.
He's embraced the same policies pursued by the other people that before him, like the Bushes.
And then one last point as far as the law is concerned, when Obama was adopted by Lolo Sotoro, the army officer in Indonesia, also CIA asset. He took the name of Sotoro, and we know this because there is paperwork of showing him being attending a elementary school in Jakarta, and all children were required to carry identification cards at that time. It was a police state, and only Indonesian citizens could attend school, and you had to be a Muslim in addition to that. So I think only Muslims could be Indonesian citizens. I think anything else was outlawed. But that sounds like a great place to live, right? So he takes the name of Sotoro because it was the law in Indonesia was that a person could take a child who was no older than 5 years old and could become a citizen of Indonesia just right there, just like that. And the United States' law states that children would not have their citizenship relinquished unless they had some kind of positive action toward reaffirming their citizenship at a later date. And I think it was up until the age of 25. Now, why that's significant is because when Obama traveled to Pakistan, I think it was in 1981. He traveled to Indonesia at that time. Now, that's kind of a shady area, a shady time period, and there's not a lot of record of where he was, which way he traveled, that sort of stuff. We know he went to Pakistan. His mother was there at a time. He also went to India. He stayed with some wealthy families in Pakistan who were CIA connected as well. What he was doing over there, I have no idea, but that kind of doesn't really matter unless you want to look deeper into the CIA angle. But now there's a possibility the reason he had to go to Indonesia was because he had to reaffirm his Indonesian passport because his name was still Sotoro, not Obama. Now, and there's also another angle that he didn't file his Selective Service draft registration card at the age of 18, and that is completely fraudulent as well. That came out in 2008.
And, of course, this all doesn't make him the worst person in the world.
Each one individually doesn't, but the fact altogether, they sort of add up.
How can we know so little about the man who becomes president of the United States?
I know.
And he comes across to us as the instrument of change and implies he's going to bring peace, and then we end up with just the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I'm just looking through the notes here from Philberg to make sure I covered all this.
Do we have time to give out the phone number one more time?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we are at 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context, and we're talking about President Obama's birth certificate and whatever else it seems to be missing from his record. The name of the program is In Context, on where we're broadcasting at WPKN. 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. WPKN.org is where we stream.
And so there's no sign of Casey out there?
Okay. No, I think Casey's coming up. Casey is intended to follow us, but we're not exactly sure when.
All right.
We're filling in for Dave Schwartz tonight.
Yeah, we're already
from 10 to 12.
We're already running 5 minutes over.
In context, our the Pecans Live Call-In Show is on normally the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. and the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m.
Yeah, we actually have a phone call, so
let's go.
We'll take that. Carl, are you with us?
Hello.
Yes, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New Haven.
Okay.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. Do you have any information directly linking Obama, President Obama, to the CIA? Not his mother, not his grandfather, but any information that links him directly to the CIA?
Well, also, as far as like a pay stub?
Any information?
Yeah.
Any
information. No, there are.
It's all circumstantial.
Yeah, it's all like who he stayed with and who he was hanging out with.
It's the nature of the beast. It's all circumstantial. I mean, Madsen's report, which you can read online, and I've read them, and it's all circumstantial evidence. But of course, you know, these guys, it's the nature of the beast that they don't admit anything.
Well, actually, you know what? Take that back. There is one connection I know of. The first company that he worked for out of college, the name escapes me. I didn't come prepared with that. But that company was operating as a CIA front out of Chicago.
Oh, that's right. That was, I have that. That was Business International Corporation.
Business International.
Yeah.
That is a CIA front.
CIA front that conducts seminars, and he worked for them in 1983. But you
okay.
know, when the caller,
I think there's one thing that I think needs to be important, needs to be said, you know, that is this racist overtone of this attack.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to give you an example. When they began to entertain ideas of running Arnold Schwarzenegger for the presidency, which was not too long ago, they were talking about getting rid of that clause or that rule in the Constitution about the president having to be born in the continental United States.
Yeah, I tell you, I wasn't supporting that.
Yeah, he was born in Austria, right?
Right, and his father was supposedly had been
a Nazi
in charge of a concentration camp.
Yeah, he was a Nazi supporter, sure.
Right, and of course we know that Henry Kissinger was not born in the United States.
Right.
You know, his Americanism never was in question. And we also know that the big move, Brzezinski.
Exactly.
Was also not born in the United States.
You are absolutely right on. And these guys... and we thank you for the call. We have another one. We're going to go to that.
Thank you, Carl.
You're dead right on, man. Our government is run by un-American people, top to bottom. And caller, are you on? You with us?
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Virginia. I just in Washington D.C. This is Doug Eccles.
Hi. Good evening, Doug.
Hey, Doug.
Osama bin Laden was killed today. The president's going to be announcing that shortly.
No.
Again?
Again?
Hello?
Yeah. We're stunned because we thought he died in 2001. That's what the Egyptian press said.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah, so he's going to announce it. Well,
I'm going to have to check this out
This is fascinating. Yeah.
Alrighty.
Okay. Thank you for that.
That's a real break. Thanks, Chuck.
Yeah, I'm going to check this out right now.
All right, have a good time in Virginia.
Osama bin Laden killed. Let's see.
We're all checking out right on the internet.
16 minutes ago. Oh, boy. 16 minutes ago.
This is amazing. I wonder how they're going to produce this, because the Egyptian press stated with quite great confidence back, I think, that in 2001, that he was killed, I believe, he died in December 2001, and the source was a man who attended his funeral.
Wow. You know, I can't even believe this. So, all right.
So how do they...
Before we get into
this...
This
is bizarre, story, right?
This is so bizarre. This is news breaking right here on In Context. I always wanted to say that.
So
the distraction of the birth certificate, right? Everybody's catching on to how fake it is.
Right.
What's going on with this guy?
So now they've come
CIA,
up
all this sort of stuff. You know, now we're really digging deep into it, and people are starting to pay attention.
So
of course, the mainstream media never covers it.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, headlines. ABC News, Osama bin Laden killed by U.S. strike. This is May 1st, 2011. Osama bin Laden, hunted as the mastermind behind the worst-ever terrorist attack on U.S. soil, has been killed, sources told ABC News. His death brings to an end a tumultuous life that saw bin Laden go from being a carefree son of a Saudi billionaire to terrorist leader and the most wanted man in the world. Yeah, yeah. Bin Laden funded, he funded Al-Qaeda.
So he was, so how, what are they going to prove that the man that killed Osama bin Laden?
In a video film 2 months after Osama gloated about the attack, which was admittedly fake.
It was a fake video.
Our terrorism is against America. Our terrorism is, sure it was.
So this is coming from you, from the same people who gave you the fake confession.
Yeah, and the CIA who said, sure, we make fake videos, but it's for the better.
It's for the better. This is unbelievable because, you know, we're really degenerating, and listeners, pardon our skepticism, but Gus and I have done a lot of coverage of 9/11. We did we've done several specials on it, and the notion that Osama bin Laden is still alive to be killed is very hard to swallow. The man was in very poor health in 2001, and there was a report in a large Egyptian newspaper back in 2001 that he died from his disease.
He was taking kidney dialysis at a U.S. base 1 month before 9/11.
And the man who gave the report to the Egyptian paper said, "I was there at the funeral. I saw them put Osama in the grave." And in fact, the Defense Department said that it was after that time they lost track of him. It seemed pretty likely he was dead, and the Pakistani authorities believe he's dead, and so now they've killed him.
Now they officially killed him.
He was, to me, it's hard to believe that they would kill him because he was the Goldman of, Emmanuel Goldman?
Emmanuel Goldstein.
Goldstein, I'm sorry, from 1984.
Yeah, but Ken, they're just going to kill him again.
The fantasy villain that the Big Brother kept alive.
Yeah, but they'll tout this victory, and then in 3 months when they do another distraction, they'll say they killed him again.
And they killed him. They can only kill him once.
Officially, yeah.
I guess there must have been a good reason to kill him this time,
but
I suppose.
But the reason,
it's so bizarre, ladies and gentlemen. You know, we really appreciate your support for this station because we're here to try to bring some kind of a bit of objectivity, detachment to a media that's so controlled by the government that you really don't know which end is up anymore. And this new story seems so totally incredible.
Wait, mean we're going to get out of Afghanistan?
I guess he's dead, yeah. Because he was the reason supposedly we went there. But, I mean, the whole, you roll the film back and you start with the fact that all the scientific evidence now shows that it's almost impossible for Osama bin Laden to have been behind 9/11. Stephen Jones posited 5 years ago that the science behind the collapse of the World Trade Center was consistent with a controlled demolition using some variety of thermite. And then about 2 years ago, an international team of scientists found super thermite in several samples of World Trade Center dust debris, thereby establishing in my mind pretty clearly that the building was demolished using a state-of-the-art incendiary, which is manufactured, is known to have been manufactured in U.S. government labs. So the notion that he pulled it off is very pretty hard to swallow. It's almost certainly not true. Who did it? Well, we don't know now. Maybe we'll never know, but I don't think it was Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
So anyway, he was the pretext for our invasion of Afghanistan and occupation.
And Iraq.
And Iraq. 10 years later, we're still on there. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen,
Pakistan.
It never changes. Governments always do what they do for money and power. And at the same time, they always have some rationale. You know, in our case, it's fighting terrorism, it's getting Osama bin Laden, or in Libya, it's humanitarian goal. But that's always BS. The truth of the matter is it's about money and power. It's just that the rationale varies from time to time.
Here's some more information. It says Osama's body is in possession of the U.S., having been killed in Pakistan as the result of U.S. Special Forces and CIA operation, according to the first leaks of reporting from the U.S. television networks. So
they'll produce some kind of evidence which they'll claim to identify him.
You know, but that shows that they wanted to justify the invasion of Pakistan because they're saying that the strike's probably a drone strike.
Yeah, probably.
So they'll say,
yes.
Look how great the drones are. Look how great our violation of Pakistani airspace is.
Well, you know, the timing of this could be the fact that the Pakistanis, has been reported, have told us that we have to stop the drone strikes.
Yeah, it's time to get the heck out.
And they want us out. They captured one of our CIA agents murdering some citizen there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've told us to get out. And the Pakistanis, any government really can't resist anymore. It's the anti-American.
Sure, yeah, and Congress's approval rating is 9%, and 60% of people disapprove of President Obama.
So maybe they're probably trying to leverage the Pakistanis as well as the American people. But there's always got to be some kind of a rationale. There's that great quote from Hermann Göring, who, hard to believe he would say anything we'd want to quote, but he said, people never want war. He said, but Göring said, but I believe he said this at the Nuremberg trials. He says, but that's no problem. And he said, I don't care whether you have a dictatorship or a democracy. You're always going to be able to drag them along. You just make them scared, and anybody who disagrees with you, you used to call them unpatriotic.
Yeah.
And you get your war.
Wow.
And unfortunately, Hermann Göring was all too right.
The fact that they have the body, that's really something. Do you think they're going to allow anybody to actually look at it?
It can't be. I think it's extremely unlikely that it really is Osama bin Laden. So they're going to have to give some evidence, which they'll say conclusive. But look, that this birth certificate was swallowed hook, line, and sinker without any question by the New York Times and then the network. So I think whatever evidence
well,
they put out...
Well, remember, the news media is a one-way stream.
Yes,
you know, they just download into your house. You can't demand that CNN... You know, answers your question. If they don't get the return information that they like through their Twitter comments or their online comments or the emails, they just don't air them.
That's right.
You know, they control what you see.
That's right. You know, democracy is supposed to work as a conversation amongst us, the three people, right? And then this conversation percolates up to our elected representatives, and they kind of form a consensus out of what do they hear from us.
But no, instead they just pontificate with blinders on and with earplugs
not
in.
Not anymore.
And they just talk and talk.
I try writing to your congressman, and I do. I write to a congressman. I have a Democrat now. I used to be a Republican. The same thing. I would send in my detailed letter or email, and I would get back a form answer.
You get a form mail.
Thank you
get
for
a
your
form
inquiry.
Letter from an assistant. Who's,
exactly. Yeah. Send them foreign policy letter number 3, and that's what I get. So it's a one way conversation. So it's going to be, would anybody like to comment on this extremely important story? At our number is 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context, WPKN's live call and show. We've just gotten word that Osama bin Laden has been killed by an aerial attack, apparently, or a special forces attack.
Yeah, we have another phone call
in Pakistan.
Go ahead, caller.
Oh.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from in the car. I'm in driving on my way home from Connecticut.
Oh, great.
All right.
I'm listening to your show for the first time, and I got to say, you guys are realists. I love you guys.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And,
that's what we're trying.
I want to just talk real quick. I mean, I remember reading this story. I'm 29 years old, I'm a Republican, but I remember reading this story about Lusitania, and the taking Lusitania, and how that made the U.S. want to go to war, and how that was U.S. driven, you know?
Well, yeah, and you know, behind the Lusitania, the Nazis took out full-page articles in New York Times saying, do not launch the Lusitania, we know it's carrying weapons, we're going to sink it.
That's right, World War One. This is a famous...
Yeah.
World War I, exactly. And,
right.
And you know, I read about that, and then there was a movie I watched, it was called The Zeitgeist, and it's a...
I'm familiar.
It's a biography, it's a really great movie, I really
Zeitgeist,
I recommend people to watch that. But, I mean, you guys are right on, I think, and it's like you guys are realists and people are just being manipulated, and it's you know what, it's how it's been and it's how it will be, and it's us little people who really think like you, who are just, you know, living a life and trying to just understand really,
do you ever feel like reality is actually insanity? You know, the doublespeak from 1984? Like, we're talking amongst ourselves, and we feel sane talking to each other, but it's almost like we feel crazy because the 99% of the people, or at least all the visual imagery we see out of TV and radio, tells us that we're lunatics.
Right. Exactly. There's not many of us, but man, I'm glad to hear about you guys. It,
well, thanks so much.
I'll be listening to you guys more often. Yeah. I drive home from New Jersey here and there, so.
Well, we're on the
first
Sunday at 10 and the first Wednesday at 6:30 at the moment.
All right,
that's our
cool
schedule.
Stuff, man.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling.
All right, guys. Thank you.
I guess there's at least more than one other person out there.
You
like
know,
this.
It's really, I really appreciate that call because it's nice to have some ratification because you often feel like you're just so alone.
Definitely.
Because you're, I just say, it's a one-way conversation. You turn on the networks, a CNN,
not here,
Fox,
though.
Or whatever.
No, you call up, you get on the air. You know, I'm not going to censor you. I'm not going to tell you
That's
can't
right.
disagree with
That's
me or
right.
you can't agree with me.
Yeah, we have, we have a point of view, and if you had a point of view, you got every right to express it. I mean, the airwaves belong to the public, and we also thank our listeners for supporting us in the spring. Fun drive.
Call.
We have another call?
Yeah.
Sure.
Caller, go ahead. Whoops.
Hello?
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Hi, Washington, Connecticut.
All right, go ahead.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to know your what you thought about how Donald Trump's is implicated in all this.
Yeah.
He's part of the cover-up then, correct?
Well, you know, the thing with Donald Trump is that he... now, this is really interesting because in the run-up to the release of the birth certificate, you knew that something was about to happen because he was on TV constantly.
Right.
And there are other people who are way more credible with way better information and way original research who should have been on television, but instead Donald Trump with his comb over gets on TV and gets on his soapbox, and
he
all of a sudden
supposedly spent millions trying to get the document and figure out if it was legitimate.
Yeah, but he's so late to the party. He's like the last person on the block to try to talk about this.
Right, and then they make him eat crow.
Exactly.
When they produce the document.
But the thing is that he's so uneducated on the issue that he doesn't even know what to look for if the thing is a fake.
So maybe, listener, what he's into it for is just the publicity, perhaps, and he doesn't really care.
I think so.
One way or the other.
But you're absolutely right. The CIA has been behind everything for well over 50 years. Since the end of the Eisenhower administration.
Yes.
They've been controlling everything, every move the world makes.
I think it's really true, and if you get in their way, it's pretty dangerous, because look at John F. Kennedy as
exactly
a coup d'etat in 1963.
Yeah. Keep up the good work about the 9/11 stuff, too. I mean, it's like, you know, sooner or later it's going to get out. They can't even get a referendum in New York State to, you know, to have a legitimate... examination of all the
facts. They can't get that on the ballot? No?
No. Did you hear about the building what?
Yes.
The federal judge?
Yes.
Yeah.
About the judge? What about the judge?
Well, they went to the judge to try to get a referendum on the ballot, and these were, family members in that. Manny Badillo and Rob McElvain. And this federal judge, they said, well, you know, they were trying to explain, what about Building 7, you know? And the judge says, building what? Now there's a whole campaign, and they have ads on.
Right. I've seen those.
Which ads are these ads?
It's buildingwhat.com.
Yes.
And it's because most people have no idea what Building 7 even is. You know,
right.
It's the third skyscraper to fall on 9/11.
Fell
at free fall speed, and, you know, we've covered it ad nauseum here before.
That's the prime example of a controlled demolition. Mm-hmm. Every expert has said that. Why our intelligence and our CIA and our FBI can't determine that? You know?
Absolutely. It's so obvious, and you go on one of these demolition sites and you see commercial demolitions and you see building number 7.
But you know what?
Same thing.
You see building 7, they get away with it. It's the worst crime of the millennia, and then they try to pull off something fake like this Obama birth certificate stunt, and it just seems like it's just kind of a degradation of common sense. You know, so it's almost like the crime gets more and more obvious and more easy to figure out.
Yeah.
We did a show on propaganda. And
Mark Crispin Miller.
With Mark Crispin Miller. And he said, governments tell big lies because big lies are easier to get away with than little lies.
Sure.
People tell little lies themselves, so they're willing to they can catch that. But if you tell them a colossal lie, they won't get it because they can't believe anybody would tell a lie like that.
Yeah,
and then introduce the fear factor every time, and people will do anything to be protected.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, keep up the good work, guys. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Calling.
We appreciate it. Give us the phone number again, Ken.
Yeah, we're at 203. Where's the 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756, and we were talking earlier about Obama's birth certificate, which was made public, but in the few minutes we've been discussing, too, the report that Osama bin Laden has been killed by the American military in Pakistan, and that is quite big news. So our phone number, if you'd like to comment, is 203-336-9756. 9756.
You think anyone's going to collect that bounty that they had?
Oh, wow. What's interesting is that, you know, they mentioned these reports. What wanted for is, you know, mastermind of 9/11.
No, not 9/11. It was the other ones.
But if you go to the FBI website, they don't. He's not wanted for 9/11.
No, no, he's wanted against the coal.
The coal and embassy bombings. But the FBI says, well, we don't have enough evidence to link him to 9/11,
yeah.
Which is true. And what is so bizarre is, and I mentioned this in our blog at incontextreport.com, is what we need is a real criminal investigation of 9/11. It never happened.
Mm-hmm.
They never had forensic fire people go in and look at the debris there. It was all hauled away.
Right.
They've never, if you look at NCIS.
Yeah, it's now in the USS New York, a big battleship.
NCIS or Bones, they would have figured out who did this by halfway through the episode,
yeah,
right?
The second commercial break, they were hot on the trail.
I mean, Osama bin Laden was one of the early suspects that would have been discarded, right?
Yeah, they would have brought him in, slammed some paper down in front, and be like, where were you? And he'd be like, oh, I don't know nothing about this.
And then some other guy would come in and say, well, he clearly didn't do it. It looks like for a bigger fish.
His alibi checks out.
Exactly. So that's what they're telling us now, they killed him. So
wouldn't it be the icing on the cake if it turned out that one of the many hundreds of times they waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that he actually released the real location of Osama bin Laden, and that's why they were sending drones into Pakistan all this time, because they were working on a waterboard testimony or something like that?
Anything is possible.
Wouldn't that really just be the tip-top? just to justify everything that they have done illegally in the past 10 years,
that's right.
You know?
That's right. Well,
or better yet, it was because they were phone tapping some American citizen.
Yeah.
Some homegrown terrorist or something like that. So just you better thank AT&T, because they were listening in on your cell phone call, and they happened to pick out this terrorist phone call.
And you know, you mentioned that eavesdropping, one of the characteristics of the Obama administration is they've continued the same snooping on the American people that Bush Jr. was doing.
I know. And we have another phone call.
Hi, good evening.
Caller, where are you from?
New Haven.
All right, go ahead.
I'd like to have at least 2 minutes of the airtime to speak to you.
You go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead and talk, yeah.
I never hear anything about the bin Laden family
mm-hmm.
being interviewed and disseminating through the media where they are, what they have to say. I mean...
Well, that was a big story on that when they remember when they were allowed out of the country by Bush Jr. without ever being interviewed, right after the...
It was on the 12th, I think.
Right. Do you remember? There were a lot of family members in this country, and Bush Jr. got them authorized their plane to take off, and they were never interviewed.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised that they're back. They came back through
it. Oh, I bet. I bet it wasn't too long, yeah.
You know, I mean, international, this globalization of everything, you know, corruption. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. It's corruption. It's about
not
money.
Only that, but
money.
I mean, I'm just saying, you hear nothing about who died in the Washington, D.C. Pentagon crash. What happened there?
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Who died? Where are the funerals? I mean, who are the people? Where's the information?
Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever seen the videotape by General Stubblebine?
Yes.
You can see it on YouTube. Does that name from General Stubblebine? He does an interview, which is on YouTube. It's only about 5 minutes, but he's interviewed by a European TV station, and he said he identifies himself as he was the head of Army Intelligence, and his job was to analyze, one of his main responsibilities was analyzing photographs. And he said,
he's part of disinformation.
Stubblebine said on European TV, he said, I can tell you without a doubt that whatever hit the Pentagon was not an airplane. He said they've been lying to the American people about it. The press hasn't told the American people the truth. He says, no question in my mind.
Yeah, he was retired, right?
He was retired.
So he
Albert Stubblebine. It's a great interview if you just Google his name.
Drone technology, you can create an aircraft and fly with nothing in it, dummies, whatever. Do all of that, okay?
That's right.
A former United States Air Force Cold War electronic dangerous and strategic air command. I repaired the nuclear bombing and navigation systems in strategic air command under General Curtis LeMay from 1955 to 1959, repairing the B-47s and the same K-series bombing system and the when I was discharged in 59, the A-1 bombing systems that had been modified and come up and replaced on the B-47s and the B-52s, I repaired them. I was an ace.
All right.
Okay? And when I re-enlisted, I became an instructor.
Okay.
Within the system. And then cross-train over and have developed a strategic cruise missile course, the AGM-77 Hound Dog missile underneath the B-52. I wrote the math course for the missile school, the transistor theory, the diode logic course, the astronomy course, the astro-tracking KS-120 and KS-140 astro-tracking systems from 59 to 61 at Chinook Air Force Base.
All right. I'm not going to argue with those credentials.
I was discharged at gunpoint.
Wow.
Why was that?
What was that for?
Because I denounced nuclear warfare in the middle of my class.
Wow. Good for you.
I got to hand it to you.
I have to holler. That was
a nightmare. It's all in my records. They slipped and right I could see it coming. They were losing them while I was in there, dropping them accidentally. They got some of them off the coast on the Atlantic, off of South Carolina, Georgia. I know that the air wing base, you can see it. It's documented. They didn't get it.
So
you got the hydrogen bomb off of Spain. Okay, so the world found out about it. The Russians couldn't get there. So we got that. Okay?
Are we just lucky that we haven't had a major explosion by accident?
Well, go back to Goldsboro, North Carolina, January 24, 1961, at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. B-52 cracks up in the air. Two hydrogen bombs jettison. It's public information.
But they didn't...
One by parachute, the other one free falls, and guess what happened?
What happened? I'm suspense.
The interlocking safety mechanism that triggered the bomb all went off, except how many did it stop at before it was a thermonuclear? Right there in Wayne County. North Carolina, January 61, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, that B-52.
So it was very close to going off?
One switch!
And it would have been off, and that would have been a humongous disaster.
Many
it would have been worse than humongous. It would have been indescribable, because you know why?
Why would that?
A ground zero, with that kind of megatonnage, and all the other bombs, and all the other explosives, and all the other stuff, going out for miles in that whole area of that county, all back out in other counties, and all kind of stuff connected, all those bombs on the base.
Wow.
It takes an atomic bomb to trigger a hydrogen bomb. So if you got both on the base and the bomb dump stuff stored, what are you talking about?
The whole
southern eastern half of the whole United States gone, evaporated. One switch, my friends. I went over the 2 minutes. They're probably going to cut me off in the Pentagon. No, I'm serious. You know, they hate me.
This is a place where we pride ourselves in giving you a chance.
Can I tell you something?
My hands are in my lap right now.
I'm going to back off because, listen, I know what's going to happen. When Harry Minot was there, they announced they were going to bring me on for an interview at 3:30 in the morning. The transmitter shut off from 3:30 to 6 in the morning at the tower.
Yeah, yeah.
Inside, the amp blew.
Wow.
At 3:30 when I was supposed to come on, I said, Harry, I called it 6 days later. I said, Harry, I want to call it. The GPUC, the FCC, you know, we're all right. I love everybody there. I'm a great supporter for more than 20-some years over there. Okay?
Well, we really appreciate that. Thank you so much for calling. It's great
thank
to hear
you
from
you.
Thank
you all so much. Before I kill my phone, but keep kicking it. I'm listening. I'm here.
All right, buddy. Thank you for the call.
All right.
That was cool.
It was great to hear that listener and also to hear that he's a supporter of WPKN. And this is WPKN's Spring Fun Drive. And while we don't have anybody back in the back office to answer the phone, we would really appreciate if you go to WPKN.org and make a secure pledge to keep independent, listener-sponsored radio on the air. We are 89, WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming live at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Canavero. The name of our show is In Context, WPKN's live call-in show. And we are here at the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. and on the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. And this Wednesday, we're going to have a special fundraising show. We're going to talk about alternative cancer cures.
Yeah.
And alternatives to radiation and chemotherapy. And our premium is going to be a book that and a CD that describe over 20 non-toxic cures for cancer. So that's 6:30 p.m. This coming Wednesday, May the 4th.
Did you give out the website address? I was messing with the dials over here.
Our website address is incontextreport.com, and please go there. And you can examine the Gus's analysis of Obama's President Obama's birth certificate. Gus is a photographer, graphic artist, and a graphic designer, and it's a pretty pretty thorough analysis technically, which leads one to the I think almost inescapable conclusion that the document was manufactured.
Well, at least for me.
Would they have used Adobe Illustrator or would they some variety of that? Is that without an adequate
Well, those
creator?
Programs all work together. The Adobe Suite is produced to work together. So you could have Photoshop, which is specifically for raster graphic, if you remember the differences between Factory
right.
and Raster. It gives you very extensive, in-depth editing capacities to affect the appearance of something. And then Illustrator is more of a layout program.
I see. So let's say you took a blank form with this watermark on it that showed it was a government form, but nothing's filled in. What would you have used? What software would you most likely have used or could you have used to create something what appeared on the
internet? Well, that's a good question. If I was going to manufacture a signature from scratch, say, I would take a sample of whatever signature I could find that's closest.
Is that the hardest part of this document? Or I mean... they have a lot of numbers in there. And
yeah, they have a lot of numbers. I mean, it's a combination of the two.
Yeah.
You know, and to get in depth into how I would have created it, well, I mean, you kind of...
But you wouldn't say, oh, I'd take Adobe Illustrator.
No.
That would be much
no,
more
it's case by case, and it's even case by case within each element in the in the document.
Okay.
So it's case by case as far as even laying out or getting your samples of text. And we still have... We have another phone call. I'm shocked we're getting so many calls. Hold on a second. Caller, you're on with us. Where are you calling from? Hello?
Hello, caller? You're on the air.
Sounds like a bad cell connection. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, where are you calling from?
Calling from Bridgewater.
All right, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, boy. I have to get my train of thought back after That last gentleman that called just really blew my mind.
That was pretty heavy, huh?
Blew our minds, too, yes.
Wow. Let me shut this off. Okay. The gentleman that just called with that information he just dropped, that was quite enlightening. And then it also makes me get to my point where it really doesn't surprise me that our government that was supposed to be by the people, for the people, has totally gone by the wayside.
Yes.
And now I was just going to say before you gentlemen are talking about how the CIA connection with Obama and just in general with a lot of the past presidents that have been here, I was going to say, why stop there? Let's go back. Let's see. We have Patrice Lumumba. We have, my goodness, we already said before, yeah, JFK. Don't forget about RFK. Don't forget about Malcolm.
Sure, sure.
Forget about Martin.
That's right.
So that was it. And then he just said all of that coming in. It's like, boy, and I really, that's funny. Even me, I thought this was going to be a big change, having Obama in there, as you said, the president of change and so on and so forth. And
yes.
Just watching his actions, not saying now being a supporter or a naysayer or whatever, kind of still in between, just trying to see what happens. But all I can come up with is the same thing.
Yes.
It's still the puppet masters behind the
that's
scenes.
That's it. The puppet
it's
masters.
Still
the image,
pulling the strings. Because as you said, same thing. It doesn't matter who you put in.
It's going
to be the same thing. And my one question is to the listeners out there that are there, and I know there's quite a number of us out there, I've been listening for the past, good Lord, 20, 25 years, and I just wonder, I've always known it's going to take a revolution to make change, but the thing is, I don't think people are actually ready to put it down and go do what it's doing, you know, what needs to be done.
Well, listen, you think it has to get worse before it gets better, maybe?
Oh, it's just beginning to start to get worse. You haven't even seen it yet. And the other thing, too, that makes me laugh is now they're talking about the Bin Laden thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's to take precedent over the dollar devaluation, our $14 trillion debt, the fact we can't even pay a bill in this country without borrowing money first.
Yes, oh yeah, and that's the other thing, too. People need to realize, too, now that our credit right now, if we don't pull ourselves out of the our credit debt that we are in right now with the countries, and basically, I guess, to China and Japan, whatever, we don't pull that out, they're cutting our credit off. I think that that's bad. Now, as I said, it's just the beginning if it doesn't turn around yet.
And I wonder if the powers that be are going to have their money out of the dollar the day before the dollar collapses, the way the well-connected did in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't think that the Cheneys and the Bushes and all those others that are around here haven't done that already, and let's put it this way, they've been doing that since they wanted to get all of the oil that we needed over in Iraq and so on. And wherever there's oil, just as we're seeing that with Libya, gee, what else can we get into?
That's right. That's right. And they're not looking out for the national interest, that's for sure. They're looking out for number one.
Not at all. So they said it's just the beginning. So people out there, wake up. You need to come up with a plan because before my phone gets shut off, revolution is inevitable. I don't know when my lifetime, but it's inevitable because these people are just not in the light anymore.
Well, we thank you very much for the call.
I'm going to
let you go. It sounds like your phone's dropping out there a little too much. But, it seems like shutting off transmitters and cracking into phones is sort of a recurring theme tonight. I definitely know that, we're all sticking our necks out there admitting the truth.
We are.
That's something that is a crime these days.
It is. And you feel alone. I get strength from our callers.
Yes.
I must say, it's very rewarding to have these calls and to know that we're not alone, because we feel very strongly, because Gus and I come down here, like all the other staffers here, all the programmers at PKM, we're volunteers. We don't get paid, and many of us are making our contributions
ever with these viewpoints, right?
Right. And we're making our contributions financially, too, to the station, and we really appreciate the listeners who are keeping us on the air. And we don't have phone people back there now, but if you can go to WPKN.org, you can make a secure contribution to keep the station on the air.
Yes.
For our spring fund drive.
Yes, our spring fund drive, which is cranking right along. Did you see the article about the sting against the Amish milk farmer?
I missed that. No. What was the story with the sting?
The FDA, the Amish are able to sell dairy and stuff at their own under their own rules, and they sell raw milk, which is something my family drinks. It's unpasteurized, unhomogenized, and it's getting late. I can't even remember the basic fundamentals of milk.
Why do they need to sting the Amish guy?
I don't know. They make up their own rules as they go. I mean, a couple weeks ago, they had the SWAT team broke into the homeschoolers because the woman wasn't giving her child medication. It was like mind-altering medications they said that he needed, and she refused to give it to him. So the SWAT team came in with guns drawn.
This is not, no joke. It was
no joke.
They bring guys with guns to come into a mother's house and threaten her and her child.
Yep, and here's the quote from the FDA. It's the FDA's position that raw milk should never be consumed, so they're going to take it upon themselves to go into an Amish farm with guns drawn and confiscate their milk.
And who are they protecting?
Nobody.
FDA is not protecting us. The FDA, as we learned from our show with Tanya Harder Pierce on cancer, it suppresses a lot of life-saving drugs, life-saving medicines. I shouldn't say they're often natural medicines. They're not drugs. And why do they suppress them? Because they cut into the profits of the pharmaceutical companies that control the FDA. So it's kind of a bit of a joke to suggest that they're out there protecting us.
Yeah, and we've been drinking raw milk for a long time, and it's not like it's unfiltered. It's not like you're drinking it right out of the udder. It's filtered. It's chilled. It's prepared as food should be, and it's sent to your house and you drink it. And, when the milk starts to get sour, you can use it for sour cream, and you know, you can use it for all different kinds of things in your house. It's more usable than regular milk, which gets spoiled because it's got no living enzymes.
I see. The milk you get in the store doesn't last as long.
Well, no, it lasts longer.
It lasts longer.
But when it gets past its expiration date, it sours. I mean, sorry, it spoils. It becomes rancid. And so it's no longer usable.
Oh, I see.
It's actually bad. You can't drink it.
Whereas
with raw milk, you can drink it at any point where it becomes sour, and then it starts to turn into sour cream, or you can make cream cheese out of it. It's got live enzymes in it, and it becomes cultured. So you can consume it at any time. It's sour. You know, you have to sweeten it to make sour cream, but... there's nothing deadly about it.
Well, I wouldn't deny that the government has a role in promoting healthy foods and protecting our health. But in pursuance of that, you'd think they'd do something about all the junk food with all these horrible
additives. That's why it's a double standard.
You walk into a store, why isn't the government doing something about all the junk food that's loading our kids with cornstarch?
Yeah, and they advertise it to kids on Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah, you know, all this junk in them, making them obese, contributing to childhood
diabetes.
And why isn't the government there helping us? Well, the reason's obvious.
Yeah.
Because the guys with the money are paying off the guys in the
government. You're asking a question.
That's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, exactly. You know the answer.
Right.
I don't know. I'm just scanning the articles here. Some of these catch my eye, and I don't even know what to say about it.
We're here at 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context, WP Ken's live call-in show with Gus Cadavero and me, Ken McDermott Rowe. And our call-in number again is 203-336-9756. We were talking earlier about Obama's birth certificate, and more recently about the reports that Osama bin Laden was killed today by American forces in Pakistan.
I was meaning to ask you, did you see that Sirhan Sirhan recently mentioned in a parole hearing that he was he admitted that he was a mind controlled assassin?
No, that is what some psychiatrists have been saying.
Yeah, but he's never personally taken that route before.
No, this is astounding.
This was from the LA Times on April 29th.
Of course, we did that show with Shane O'Sullivan, which you can see on our website. I interviewed Shane O'Sullivan in my previous series, History Counts, and it's archived at incontextreport.com. And there were psychiatrists who examined him in prison who were quite sure he was an MK. He had been hypnotized before, and in fact, when he was under hypnosis in jail, he had no recollection. He had no recollection of shooting Bobby Kennedy. And a professor at Columbia who has studied hypnosis said he was quite sure he had been hypnotized. And, of course, the story is that there was a woman with him with a polka dot dress
right.
who was his control and set him in motion. And, of course, then another very important aspect of that case is it's now quite clear from Shane O'Sullivan's research, that Sirhan Sirhan didn't fire the bullets that killed Robert Kennedy anyway, that the autopsy, which was available at the time, listeners may not be aware of this, but it's a matter of record, showed conclusively that Bobby Kennedy was killed from a bullet that entered him, from behind at point blank range, just around his ear.
And yeah.
And
there were multiple CIA agents implicated there that night. But this is from the LA Times. It says, in the papers, which were reviewed by the Associated Press, Sirhan Sirhan says he was led to the Ambassador Hotel with a gun by an unidentified woman in a polka dot dress. Last month, Sirhan's lawyer tried to convince a parole board that his client was a brainwashed hitman when he gunned down Senator Robert F. Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles in 1968. The board refused to release Sirhan.
I believe that he was represented by William Pepper. And William Pepper was the man who represented the King family in the very and what should have been a famous case in 1999 in Tennessee, where a jury found in less than an hour that Martin Luther King was not killed by James Ray, but he was killed in a conspiracy, mainly included government agents. And this is a really important case. William Pepper represented the King family in the civil action because the government had refused to prosecute a man named Lloyd Jowers, who all but confessed to being involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. So then he subsequently became apparently Sirhan Sirhan's lawyer. I believe he's the man who represented. And again, he did an interview, which we have on our website, in which he goes over in great detail the plot, the execution. In fact, that's the name of his book, The Execution of Martin Luther King by William Pepper, and that's at our incontextreport.com.
Did you mention the, I was looking at some dials again. Did you mention the RFK Must Die?
RFK Must Die.
Did you mention that?
Yes, Shane O'Sullivan's, and we have our interview with him at the same website.
Yeah.
And these aren't really, these are really slam dunk cases. Both the Martin Luther King case and the Bobby Kennedy case. There's no question Sirhan Sirhan could not have shot the fatal shots at Bobby Kennedy. Everybody placed him about his muzzle on an average 2 feet in front of Bobby Kennedy, parallel to the ground. And the autopsy clearly showed that Bobby Kennedy was shot from behind, point blank, from someone crouching behind him in a sharp upward direction. So there's just no way that Sirhan Sirhan did it. They knew it in 1968, and his attorneys did nothing with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of our, I think might have been the last caller, he mentioned the, just to shift gears, the last caller mentioned the debt issue. I'm looking at an article here. It says, U.S. Treasury, China has decreased its holdings of U.S. debt. And you look at the numbers, and it's going back to October of 2010, where China owned $1.175 trillion in U.S. debt securities. That's an awful lot of money.
$1.75 trillion.
$1.175.
Oh, okay. A little over a trillion.
Yeah, $1,175,300,000,000.
Okay. And they're lightening
and that,
up on it?
That number has dropped in February, so 2 months ago. To $1.154 trillion, so it's dropped.
And I understand it's a little hard to count because they, when they sell, they often do it through fronts. They make it a little difficult
for the
market to know the that the Chinese are unloading U.S. debt.
They haven't dropped a lot. It's only $20 billion, only $20 billion.
But we're running these huge deficits, so
but
you'd think it'd
the
be
fact
growing.
That it's going down.
It should be growing considering how much we're borrowing.
It's
but
going
of course,
the wrong direction.
Is, you know, we've talked about this debt situation often on in context. This is just as important a story, maybe more important than all the military operations.
Well, we can't finance the wars unless we're borrowing money.
We can't. And when they pull the plug on the dollar, it's all over. I don't, you know, interest rates will go up.
This is kind of a shot across the bow. If you look at it's kind of a warning signal because it's only, you know, in the grand scheme of things, only $20 billion because when you have $1,154,000,000,000, $20 billion doesn't seem like a lot.
But that's a good analogy. It's a shot across the bow in an economic war. And what do they need to use bullets and bombs when they've got this tremendous economic leverage over the United States because of our debt?
Yeah. Yeah, they can just start selling it off like that. And then, you know, the dollar drops. And all of a sudden, it's useless. And I mean, I know that China holds a lot, and no one who's invested in something really wants their investment to tank because it means that they're gonna take a hit financially.
That's right.
But if your end game is to actually have your enemy ruined, you'll take that financial hit because it's basically like, you know, would China pay $1.15 trillion? To have America wiped off the map as their competitor for world
and let's face it,
hegemony.
That's what it is.
Take that bet.
Now, U.S. and NATO are going head on head with the Chinese and the Russians too, and Iran, but mainly China. And do we have time? I don't know if we have time for any more calls.
We've got six, seven minutes before
KC comes on. We're at 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. So if you want to get one more call in to Gus and to me, Ken McDermott Rowe, in context, WPKN's live call-in show. We're at broadcasting WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. So we just have a few minutes left. If you'd like to get one more call-in, like to talk about Obama's birth certificate or Osama bin Laden's death in Pakistan today, or anything else that's particularly on your mind, and we just have a few minutes, we'll be happy to take your call. And we thank you for listening to the show and for supporting WPKN and our spring fund drive. We don't have any staff back here to answer the calls, but if you could make a call, go to our website, WPKN.org. You can make a secure pledge to support the station there, and we thank you very much for that.
And we do have another call. I guess we don't. Never mind.
Okay.
Here's an article by John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And he's got some great analysis into everything he writes about. But the headline to this article is, Libya, it's not about oil, it's about currency and loans.
Yes.
I'm sure this is long and well referenced, but I'll have to wait till I get home.
Maybe
to read
it goes
that.
Into the central bank taking out Libya's central bank.
Yeah, I'll just give you a little taster. It says World Bank President Robert Zoellick Thursday said he hopes the institution will have a role rebuilding Libya as it emerges from current unrest. Zoellick, at a panel discussion, noted the bank's early role in the reconstruction of France, Japan, and other nations after World War II.